It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Chef Ian Knauer will give us some advice and inspiration on how to make a perfect loaf of bread.
But first, the FDA is currently taking comments over the next week on rules that will implement the new Food Modernization and Safety Act.
Our guest today says the FDA's draft regulations could hurt some of the country's small-scale local growers.
Joining us to talk about that issue is Mark Estelle, co-founder of the Cornucopia Institute, a populist farm policy research group based in Wisconsin, and director of its Organic Integrity Project. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much. Congratulations on your new show. I think it's great.
Thank you. Well, let's start with a primer on what these new food regulations will involve.
Well, there, for some time, and I mean years, it's been obvious that large corporate agribusinesses, through neglect, have been literally poisoning the citizenry. We've had repeated major nationwide food contamination problems that have sickened and sadly killed many. And this really came to a head with a couple major incidents, the big spinach E. coli contamination problem from California a few years ago. There was a quite widespread problem with contaminated peanut products from Peanut Corporation of America, kind of literally a rat-infested facility. And so Congress finally stepped in and said, look, we got to do something more comprehensive. And we support that. Unfortunately, they've written these rules from such a global standpoint that instead of just looking at these major industrial scale agricultural businesses, and imports, which are of really questionable value and quality.
All right. Well, let's talk about a couple of the nuts and bolts. What are some that you're most concerned about?
Well, two major points. One is that they're not really looking at the root cause of why our vegetables, in this case, and fruits are becoming contaminated. There's nothing inherently dangerous, as an example, about spinach. First, you need to put manure on it. And it can't be run-of-the-mill manure. It has to come out of one of these large CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations, or factory farms, and from really sick animals. So somehow it's getting in the water. It's getting in surface and groundwater. It's getting in the air. It's being spread by manure being used as fertilizer. And the sad part about this FDA new rulemaking, even though Congress wanted them, and they did collaborate with the USDA that has jurisdiction over these industrial livestock facilities, there's nothing in there to address the contamination. The other major flaw is that they're treating all vegetables the same. We know that the bagged greens, the spinach and pre-washed lettuces, are especially because of their long shelf life, because of the way they're processed, especially vulnerable to contamination. They're treating other vegetables, unlike the bagged products that have had numerous contamination incidents, the same way. So something like a bulb onion that might be produced in the southeast part of the United States is treated just like bagged spinach from California, even though, to my knowledge, there's never been a contamination problem with the onions. So it causes the farmers to spend in aggregate millions, and then our tax dollars, the limited resources we have to oversee these businesses, are being not directed at the greatest risk.
Now, it sounds like small and beginning farmers are particularly concerned about complying with some of these rules and how much it might take off their profit margin. How would you describe the concerns that they have?
Well, I would describe them as being legitimate. So these large industrial-scale operations in California, most of them already have a quality control staff. They have laboratories to do their own testing. In a state like Wisconsin, where we have a budding movement for local foods, we have one of the most preeminent farmers markets in the country and around the Capitol Square in Madison. We have lots of CSA, community-supported agriculture farms, where consumers buy a share at the beginning of the season. These are the farmers that are really going to have the screws turned on them. In some cases, they have to test water that they're using for irrigation on a weekly basis. Even though there's no evidence of contamination, the record keeping will be very expensive, and these are family-scale farms where labor, you're already talking about farmers literally working 16-hour days in the season. Where is that time, let alone money, going to come from?
Now, Mother Jones has said, you know, to name a few examples of what the law could eliminate, the organic carrots in your kids' school lunch program, the kohlrabi in your farm share box, the pickles peddled by your favorite hipster farmer, you know, that might be an extreme view of what could happen. But do you think that the trade-off of food safety is worth some of those things?
Not this version of food safety. I can tell you that I was a fresh market certified organic vegetable producer about 20 years ago, and we had probably the most efficient food safety protocol that would be the envy of these large outfits. And that is, what we were harvesting in the cool dew of the morning was on the lunch table at noon for our family and crew. And if there was a problem, we'd know about it right away. If it was an organism that required incubation, instead of that taking place in a quality control laboratory in a petri dish, it was taking place in our gut. We never had a food contamination problem. But if we did, we know our customers. It would be on a scale akin to Aunt Tilly's egg salad being left out too long at the church picnic, not in all 50 states like the spinach problem. So we're really talking about jeopardizing probably the safest farms, owner-operated, hands-on, owner-managed. And do you want to compare that to where they're buying from Mexico, California? We really don't know where it's all coming from. In many cases, these tracebacks take months to accomplish before they're really able to ascertain where the contamination came from.
Now, it sounds like there may be some exemptions for farms making sales less than $500,000. Would that address some of your concerns about this affecting these smaller farmers?
It would if it was implemented properly. Unfortunately, Congress exempted a direct marketer, so local farmstead CSA farmers, under $500,000. But the problem is they built no due process into the regulations. So they could come to a farmer in the height of the season, again, working 16 hours a day, and say, instantly, we need you to implement all these testing protocols that you were exempt from. Farmers won't be able to do that. So we need some fairness built in here to accomplish that exemption. And I hope you will give our website out at the end. We really desperately need consumers, or the customers of the farmers, to chime in to the FDA to make their voices heard, because this really will jeopardize their access to food.
Now, there is a lot of fear around food. I mean, I guess when we see these big contamination cases, it usually seems when they're national like that, that means they've come from a large operation that distributes nationally. But there is fear, and it needs to be addressed. How would you suggest addressing some of the fear about contamination around food, if not this way?
Well, ultimately, the best thing to do is to know your farmer. And the pinnacle there is to grow it in your own garden. But when you go to the farmer's market, or you go to the Willie Street Food Co-op in Madison, or the Stevens Point Food Co-op, or Viroqua, or People's Food Co-op in La Crosse, that's like a farmer's market 7 days a week. They vet their farmers. They know their farmers. They're local. I think that gives us a level of security. I know it does for me, because I buy a lot of my own food these days, that is not an anonymous brand name, corporate-owned operation. But the bottom line is, we do need the FDA to do a judicious job of overseeing how our food is produced. It's just, we don't want them to pick on the safest farmers, and we want the resources to be applied proportionally to where the risk is.
Now, in terms of calling, you know, these smaller scale organic outfits the safest, is there a body of research to back that up? I've heard other guests in the past say that, you know, you can get an E. coli outbreak at your local farmer's market, you know the farmer's name, just as well as you can get it at a large scale factory farm. Is it really true that these small operations are safer?
Well, that is basically anecdotal. There has been no research that I know of comparing them. But when we track the reported incidents at the FDA, they're not coming from these small farms. The guest who told you that there is risk in all the food, if we're talking about fresh food, food that we're not heating up, that so like lettuce, there is some degree of risk because we're dealing with nature. But we can mitigate those risks by proper handling, and proper manure handling in terms of fertilization. And really, again, it really boils down to, are you growing vegetables where the irrigation water or the packing shed water might be influenced by a factory farm raising livestock, and that's where the greatest risks are.
Now, the FDA is taking feedback on these rules through, I think it is November 15th. How can people give their feedback?
That's correct. Well, I think the easiest way to do that right now, and it's a little self-serving to say so, they can either go to government.org or they can go to the Cornucopia website, and we'll include some talking points. And right now we have a proxy that they can download and mail in, and we'll hand carry it to the FDA. They would have to do that pretty much right away if they want theirs to go in. Otherwise, they should go directly to government.org, I think it is. It's on our website. So if you go to cornucopia.org, C-O-R-N-U-C-O-P-I-A, and click on Action Alerts, you'll get a complete briefing.
All right. Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having us.
That was Mark Castell, co-founder of the Cornucopia Institute. And we'll have that link to Cornucopia Institute's website on our Facebook page.
Coming up on our Food Friday segment, Ian Knauer will give us some tips on baking great bread. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Food Friday time now. Baking a loaf of bread from scratch might be a great way to relax this November weekend.
So we've got our bread baking ninja with us now. Ian Knauer is the host of the new PBS series called The Farm, and he's got a cookbook out by that same name. He also teaches bread baking at the Culinary Loft in New York. Ian, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me. Nobody's ever called me a bread baking ninja. I love that.
We debated about that, and we thought, you know what? Ian qualifies as a ninja.
Oh, yeah.
I have a black belt in yeast rising.
Well, let's talk about that yeast rising. I mean, a lot of us love freshly baked bread. I'm one of them. But when I bake it, it tends to come out like a bloated year-old fruitcake in texture, which is not exactly what I'm going for. Can anyone learn to make bread?
Anyone can learn to make bread. It is one of the most feared and also easiest things to make in your home kitchen. And I used to be afraid of it, too. I think it's really common because every time you try it, it somehow turns out different. You can't figure out why. Is that the problem?
Definitely. And I fear it, too, having tried it a couple times in the past. So what's the biggest mistake people make when they first start making bread?
The biggest mistake is not thinking that you're in charge. In other words, you're basically living in the yeast world, and you have to learn to understand what the yeast wants and what it's doing, and you have to read the signs. You have to be a good listener to bake bread. And so if you think you're in charge, that's mistake number one. Now, the way that you can work with that is you can realize the function of the yeast, because the yeast is this living organism that is basically feeding off the sugars and protein that are in the bread, in the flour. And they like certain conditions. So they like it when it's warm. They like it when it's moist. And if you supply them with those conditions, then they're going to behave better. They'll be happy, in other words, and they'll rise in the time that you want them to rise, and they'll give you the nice air bubbles that you want, and they'll give you the flavor that you want, too.
Now, you can buy the yeast from the store, which is how I've often done it, how I've always done it, actually. But I've also heard that you can simply use the yeast in the air somehow to make a starter.
What?
Is that advanced?
It's not that advanced. It's pretty easy. And you're right. The air is full of living things, full of bacteria. We breathe them with every breath. And some of those bacteria are really good for baking bread. Now, the special thing about your own starter, which is what you would make sourdough from, is that anywhere you are is going to be different than anywhere else. So San Francisco, for instance, is famous for their sourdough because they have certain bugs in the air that taste really sour when they are used to leaven bread. Now, the way to do this, there are a couple different ways to do this. Some people like to use grapes. So grapes have a yeast on their skin. It's called a bloom. You can actually see it. Apples have it, too. If you get apples that haven't been sprayed, they have a little film on the outside, and that is a natural yeast.
That's that white film?
Exactly. That's why you don't need to add yeast if you're making wine. You just crush the grapes, and the natural yeast that's on the skins will ferment it. So there's a natural yeast on there, and we know from, you know, thousands of years of history that yeast translates into good bread yeast. So you can take some grapes, you can mash them up, and make like a paste with some flour and then let that sit at room temperature for about 24 hours, and it will start to, those yeast and the grapes will start to eat the protein in the flour. And then you can, you know, take all your grape skins out and add some water, make it into a thinner paste, and then sort of get all the solids out. And then that's a starter. Now, another way to do it, and the way that I like to do it, is with honey, because I keep honeybees, so I have a lot of honey lying around. So I make a crude sort of paste with flour and a little bit of honey and some warm water, and I let that sit at room temperature for about 24 hours. And sure enough, in 24 hours, those natural yeast in the air start to move in, and they like the sugar that's in the honey. Honey also has a lot of minerals in it, which is good for the yeast. And then they start to set in and make a home in that flour. Now, if you want to bake with that and use it as your yeast, you need to keep it alive. So that yeast is eventually going to run out of food. So you need to take some of the, basically cut half of it out and use that to bake your bread, and then add some more flour and water. So you keep feeding that yeast and you keep going. You can keep your sourdough alive for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Wow.
I think you just blew Rob's mind.
Yeah, I'm amazed. I knew none of this. This is cool stuff. Well, all right, so we've got our yeast, whether we made it ourselves or bought that little packet at the store, and we're into the kneading stage. Let's jump up to there. Any kneading advice to get the bread the way we want it?
Yes. Well, let's start with the rest of the ingredients. So we have the yeast, we have the flour, of course, mm-hmm. we have water, and we have salt. And each one of these things has a function. So the yeast makes little bubbles of carbon dioxide that give you the holes in the bread. And the flour has gluten in it. You know, gluten is like, it's a bad word these days, but it's absolutely necessary when you're making bread. And what that gluten does is it stretches and becomes stringy. And as you knead it, you activate the gluten. And those proteins wake up. And they hold the bubbles in the bread. So without the glutens, it would just bubble away and it would look like a soda, and all that carbon dioxide would go out into the air. But with those glutens, they trap the air inside, which is what happens when the bread is rising. So you need those glutens, and then you have your water, of course, which helps mix everything together, but it also helps steam from the inside out. And that's very important because steam is what gives you a crispy crust. And then, of course, the salt helps you taste it, and it also slows down the yeast a little bit so the yeast doesn't go too crazy. So all those four ingredients are important, but again, it's only four ingredients, and you have an infinite number of breads with those four ingredients.
Well, we just posted a recipe that you gave us for your favorite baguette basic bread recipe. Tell us a little bit about that recipe that's up on our Facebook page now.
So that recipe, I learned this technique from a French baker named Richard Bertinet. He has a baking school in England, actually. And I took a week of classes with him because I was afraid of baking and I wanted to learn how to do it. So I went to the expert. And this is based on his dough. It's a little bit different, but it's mostly the same. Now, he uses a much higher proportion of water to flour than what most bakers, at least in this country, are used to seeing. So when his dough comes together, or when this dough comes together that you just posted on the website, it seems really wet to a lot of people, and that makes them nervous, of course, because it's very sticky. But what you end up with, because there's more water in there proportionately, is a super crispy crust, just like a baguette or, you know, another European-style bakery loaf. And when you cook this, even in your home oven, you don't need a special oven for this. You will get literally a bakery quality baguette at home. It's the most incredible thing. It impresses everybody who makes it and tastes it.
And that's the point of baking, after all.
Right, is to make people happy,
right.
Including yourself.
All right, the bread is made. What's your favorite way to eat it, Ian?
Well, again, you know, I mean, it depends on how fresh the bread is. So here's something that I learned. That is actually a really important tip. When you're baking bread, you want to let the bread cool completely before you cut into it or break into it. And we're all guilty of this. You know, you get excited and you think, oh, warm bread is great. And warm bread is great, but rewarmed bread is great. What happens when you cut into it, that bread is still cooking, still baking until it's cooled to room temperature because all that moisture that's trapped inside is steaming it from the inside out. And when you cut into it, you let all that out, and what you end up with is sort of like a gloppy, really gooey center of your bread. So you want to wait till it cools completely, and then if you like warm bread, warm it up again. And that's the way to eat warm bread.
That's a great tip to leave us with, Ian. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
That's Ian Knauer, host of a new PBS series called The Farm. He's got a cookbook out by the same name.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll find out why the power of Wikipedia is waning.
And we'll go stargazing and find out what to look for in our Wisconsin fall sky.
That's all coming up Monday on Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the life and music of the Man in Black. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. Lots more to come.
Johnny Cash.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we turn our attention to the life of an American music legend now, Johnny Cash.
I don't know when I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling.
Johnny Cash died in 2003, but his legacy only grew with an Academy Award-winning biopic starring Joaquin Phoenix and new fans with each generation.
Today, many people know Johnny Cash as a talented songwriter with dueling passions, flaws, and addictions. But our next guest says we only know about 20% of the story.
Robert Hilburn was the chief music critic at the LA Times for 3 decades, and his new book is called Johnny Cash, The Life. Robert, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks very, very much, Veronica.
We're just enjoying some of that music there. Now, you were at Folsom Prison for Johnny Cash's legendary concert.
That is so crazy. I can't even believe that sometimes.
Yeah.
Imagine, I was just beginning. I was trying to get a job at the Los Angeles Times, trying to convince them to hire me as a music writer. I saw that Johnny Cash was going to Folsom Prison. I pitched the story, the man who wrote Folsom Prison Blues, going to Folsom Prison and singing to prisoners. And they sent me there, and it turned out I was the only music writer there, because the record company did not invite anyone to come to the concert. They were afraid that Johnny Cash would show up stoned and they would have to cancel the concert, and they didn't want bad publicity.
So set the scene for us. What was the mood like at the prison that day when Johnny Cash and his band stepped up on the stage?
There were two things. I mean, one is the intensity of the audience. Johnny Cash had a great empathy all his life to empathize with people, especially underdogs. Plus, he had also been in jail before. He had been in handcuffs, his picture on the front page of the paper in his hometown, his mother looking at that. So he felt he could identify with those prisoners. Those prisoners, starving for some kind of entertainment, starving for some kind of joy in their life, looked at Johnny Cash in a sense as one of them. And the fact that he could make it, he could be a success, gave them some kind of hope. Plus, his music always was designed to try to give people hope. No matter how many much problems you've had, you don't lose faith. You can get better. So that there was an intense relationship. But the other part of it for me was I was scared going in the prison. Mm-hmm. I'd never been in a prison before. Plus, there was had been an incident 2 weeks before where a guard had been taken hostage, and it was very tense. The guard was released, but they were still very tense. And the prison people told the convicts, if you get out of your seat, we're going to cancel the concert. And right along the walls and the catwalk above, armed guards with shotguns were walking. So I had one eye on the concert and one eye on the prisoners.
Now, Johnny, it sounds like, kind of amped it up for the prisoners, too. He changed words to the songs, it sounds like. He sang until his throat was kind of stretched to the breaking point. So he was kind of feeding back into them, wasn't he? What did he get out of it?
Well, yeah, Johnny Cash, he was a very smart man, first of all. He had like 160 IQ. He was a very talented writer. But beyond that, the thing that made Johnny Cash important was, unlike anybody else who entered country music or rock and roll, the early days of rock and roll in the 50s, he had more ambition than another hit in the jukebox. He was always trying to make music that lifted people's spirits, especially underdogs. He could go into Native American reservations. He could go into prisons. He could go into unemployment lines. He could go to destitute farms. He could go to the White House. But he was always trying to make people's feel better. His songs tried to set examples. What is truth? The Man in Black, Sunday Morning Coming Down. He was always trying to say, don't give up. Your life can be better. And that's what made Johnny Cash so important.
At this stage in his career, what was at stake? How much importance did he put on this performance and the recording and album that came out from it?
Okay, well, he started out on Sun Records in Memphis with Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis, but he was never into teenage music. He was always more into adult music. Columbia Records signs him, gives him a contract, says you can make any kind of music you want. And there became a tension, Rob, because he wanted to make, again, these concept albums that were inspiring people about the old concept album about the old West, about Bitter Tears, Ira Hayes. And the record company wanted hits for the jukebox. So they were always saying, you got to give us more hits, John. You got to give us more hits. And they were going to drop him in 1963. They gave him one more chance to record a song. He recorded Ring of Fire. It was a big hit. Mm. They signed him to a new contract. He goes back to making concept albums. The whole time, even the Folsom Prison album, that was another one of his concept albums. And the record company didn't particularly want that. They wanted, you know, more of the old kind of hits he had on Sun and the early days of Columbia. So he was staking everything on that concert. He knew that there was this tremendous excitement in the audience at a prison. He'd done some prison shows before. So he wanted to present himself in that light. He thought it would be very dramatic, very meaningful. The record company was nervous and skeptical, but it became a huge hit. Within 2 years, he had his own television show, and he was the biggest selling record artist in America.
That's amazing. And also while he was there, he met one of the writers of one of the songs he sang, Greystone Chapel.
Yeah, that's a strange thing. You know, Veronica, when you're doing a book, you have all these premonitions, you have all these preconceived notions in your head. And that was a very dramatic part of that concert. There was a night before a prisoner gives John a song, a gospel song. And John, again, is always looking to inspire people. So he says, my gosh, what a great story. This prisoner has written this great gospel song. Maybe I can sing it. Maybe I can help him. Maybe I can get him out of here. He sings the song. He eventually gets the prisoner out. Governor Reagan pardons the guy. And it turns out, the man's name is Glenn Shirley, he had a lot of problems. He could not adjust to normal life. They put him on tour, and he threatened other members of the band. They had to drop him off the tour. And he went back home to California, eventually committed suicide. It was kind of an ill-fated chapter in John's life. But John was always looking for that heart, you know, good feel story, the heartwarming story. And a member of his band said, this guy, Glenn Shirley, played John like a fiddle. He knew that he had this vulnerable thing for the underdog, and he took advantage of it.
Well, that's an example, that story, of what you must have had to go through to sort out the legend from the story. And you've said that we know about 20% of Johnny Cash. Why do we know so little about him, from his biographies, his movies?
That was John's manager who said that. I asked the man, Lou Robin, I said, Lou, how much of the story is still to be told, or how much has been told? He said about 20% is told. And I had never, even though I knew Johnny Cash, Rob, from the time of Folsom Prison to just a few months before he died, I was doing interviews with him. I didn't think of a book of John until I saw the movie. I saw the movie and read some books that came out, and those were not Johnny Cash. That was not the story that should be told. He deserved a better story, a more complete story, a more honest story, a more accurate story, because I think he's going to be remembered for a long time, 50 years, 100 years, because as such a major figure in American pop culture. And so that was part of the thing about doing the book. I didn't think any of this other stuff told us. And what I learned was so much. You know, I thought I vaguely knew the story of Johnny Cash, even though the manager said, you know, 80% should be told. But I found out he was right. And I found out that I found out what I think. At the times, I interviewed everybody several times, Dylan 5, 8, 10 times, Bono, Springsteen, almost anybody who was making meaningful music. And I realized how little we knew about any of these celebrities or entertainers or artists, because we only know what they choose to tell us. And there's a lot they don't choose to tell us. And in Cash's case, even though he was always trying to say, I want people to know my faults, there were things he couldn't get into. And that was one of the difficult parts of the book, of some of the things you find out. What does the public really need to know? You know, how much of this is going to be useful? How much of it's just going to sound scandalous and so forth? So that was one of the hardest part of the books, of deciding what to put in and what not to put in.
Well, how does your account of Johnny Cash differ with the man that we think we know from all the other stuff that's out there? What did you learn?
Well, you know, in some ways, what you saw was all you need to know. The music that he made was so good, and I think, Veronica, the courage he had late in life in his 60s when he made those final records with Rick Rubin, when he was in such pain, he was almost blind, he'd lost the feeling in his fingers, he had diabetes, he had a neurological disease, he had constant pain from his jaw. You know, that's pretty powerful stuff, but it gives you so much more understanding of the artistic process and his own accomplishments when you realize the struggles he went through to make that music. You know, he was always trying to make music that inspired others, and almost every day of his life, Johnny Cash was fighting in some way against demons. Mm-hmm. The sadness of abandoning his children, the guilt over that, the loss of his brother, the fact his father never gave him the love he was hoping for, the insecurity of that, plus the drug addiction, you know, the infidelities with June Carter, and the fact that he felt he wasn't living up to his beliefs as a Christian, all of those things were haunting him almost throughout his life until toward the end it all kind of got resolved and he really died a man who felt he had been redeemed and was happy.
Johnny Cash seems like, you know, he was a man who was interested in redemption his whole life. It seems like that was what he was kind of on the trail of. You talked about the infidelities, the drug use, and that was always sort of warring with this other half of him, which was this guy who was brought up in the Southern Baptist tradition, who cared about faith, who cared about redemption. How did those two conflicting ideas play out in his life?
Well, I spent 677 pages dealing with that because it's a constant, constant issue. And one of the great songs, Kris Kristofferson, the great songwriter, wrote a song about Johnny Cash, and it captures it so perfectly. It took me 677 pages to explain what he meant in these four lines. He doesn't say Johnny Cash, but it says, he's a walking contradiction, partly truth and partly fiction, taking every wrong direction on his lonely way back home.
Hmm. We're speaking with Robert Hilburn. His new book is Johnny Cash, The Life.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll be back with more with Robert Hilburn talking about Johnny Cash. And we'd love to hear from you on this. What is your favorite Johnny Cash song, and what does his music mean to you? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email talk@WPR.org.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking now with music critic Robert Hilburn. His new book is called Johnny Cash, The Life.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or memories about Johnny Cash. 800-642-1234. Let's listen to one of the hits we were talking about earlier.
On this heart of mine, I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine. I walk the line.
So Walk the Line, a song about his faithfulness in that one. Talk about his infidelity and the constant issues he had with that, Robert.
Well, the thing is, Rob, he was in country. First of all, he enters the field of country music where cheating and backstage affairs, unbelievable. I mean, all those country songs, there's a reason you're cheating hard, all that stuff's written. But Johnny Cash, if I might say, was much less likely to look for groupies, to look for women backstage. He really did try to make his marriage work with Vivian, but there were inherent differences. Vivian wanted him to be home every night, having dinner with the children. He wanted to be on the road, building his career. It gets worse and worse. He's more and more resentful. He gets to where he doesn't want to come home. He's looking for somebody who understands him. So he has affairs with some other singers. music and others who are in country music, who understand what he does. And one of those was the widow of Hank Williams. Her name was Billie Jean Horton. She was also the widow of Johnny Horton. He asked her in 1961 to marry him. She says no because of the drugs. She had gone through the drugs with Hank Williams. She didn't want to go through it again. So right after that, a few months, then he meets June Carter. Billie Jean Horton said yes to his proposal, he would never have had the relationship with June Carter, which is a fascinating thing, which I learned in researching the book. And so, but when he meets June, it's not like the movie suggested. It wasn't this kind of calm, sweet devotion to each other. That it was constant torment because he was married and she was married, so that was a frustration. They would say, "Why don't you get a divorce?" She'd say, "Why don't you get a divorce?" They would break up. He'd have an affair with somebody else. She'd have an affair probably with somebody else. And in fact, when he did ask June to marry him, three other women were shocked because they thought he was going to ask them to marry him. So anyway, they get married, but there's still a bit of the marriage isn't this perfect. It's going to solve everything. There's still moments of tension between him, and he gets involved occasionally with other people. But gradually over time, it got straightened out, and it really became the fairy tale life that people like to think it always was.
Interesting. Well, he did have an affair with what, his sister-in-law?
Well, I don't mean to laugh, Veronica, because that was the saddest thing I found. I thought that was beyond. You try to forgive John for problems. You understand the insecurities he had, the drugs and stuff. But that was the darkest moment when I found out that in 1969, when June is pregnant with their first son, she learns that he's had an affair with her sister, Anita Carter. Now, that's shocking, but as you go in and you try to understand what was happening, apparently he had had affairs with Anita. When he would break up with June in the 60s, he would sometimes date Anita. So there was this history between the two of them. They were very close. That doesn't forgive him for what he did, but I'm saying that's one reason she didn't say, "I've had enough and leave," because she's used to this country music environment. And she thought it was kind of a relapse rather than if, say, a woman she didn't know came in and he was having an affair, then she might have left him altogether. But that was the darkest moment, Veronica. And again, I didn't know whether – do you put that in the book? Does anyone need to know that? And I said, yes, I thought it showed the state of mind of John, how vulnerable he was, and it also showed the determination of June Carter to make that marriage work.
Even if people didn't know all of his flaws, people knew he had flaws. Do you think that fans were attracted to him because of those flaws, in part?
I think it was. I think the flaws, and this is a sad thing, Rob, the idea that flaws and hardship and drugs and all that kind of stuff makes you a better artist. It makes you a better artist in the sense that if you're a person who has, a good heart, it makes you empathize with other people more. It makes you understand and be a little bit more forgiving. And Johnny, as I said before, he put those ideas in his music. And people who, especially people who are having, and all of us feel like we're underdogs in some way, and he just would speak to us. Again, every other country entertainer would come by, let's say, and play the auditorium in Atlanta, and they would sing their hit songs. Johnny Cash would come on stage and sing these songs that really had a meaning, and the audiences didn't just listen to the songs. They believed in Johnny Cash. They also believed in Johnny Cash and June Carter as this couple who had overcome problems and so forth and survived. And I think there's no way to understate the importance of that, the fact that people believed what he was saying. He was talking to them.
Well, let's take a caller now. We've got Gail on the line from Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment that just what you were saying about people being drawn to him. My earliest memories of Johnny Cash was when I was 6 years old. My mom dressed us all up and took us to a Johnny Cash concert in downtown Milwaukee. And it was so out of character for my mother, who was very conservative Christian, but she was obsessed with Johnny Cash. And we don't know why, but I remember when I was 6 years old seeing that amazing, huge man all dressed in black up on stage, and it just was a wonderful memory.
Wow, that's amazing. You were only 6 years old and you went to a Johnny Cash concert.
Yes, and I'm 52 right now.
Well, Gail, thanks for the call, but Robert, I mean, is that so out of character? Johnny Cash saw himself as a conservative Christian in a lot of ways, didn't he?
I'm sorry?
Johnny Cash saw himself as a conservative Christian
absolutely.
In some ways.
He was raised in the Baptist church. He, as a child, he went to the church three times a week, Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Wednesday evening, the gospel songs. He really believed in hell and fire and brimstone. That was his firm belief. That was what was so terrible to him when he faltered, you know, when he did things he thought were not living up to that. Again, that was another pain that Johnny Cash suffered. But what she says was interesting because there was the charisma of Johnny Cash. Boy, he was so exciting to watch. Aside from the purpose and the meaning of his music, he was a very charismatic figure on stage.
Well, let's flash forward a little bit. It seemed in the 90s that Johnny's career was, you know, if not over, at least, you know, definitely at a low point. And he came back, and part of it was to do with this song called Hurt.
What have I become? My sweetest friend. Everyone I know goes away in the end.
And that song was written by Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails, but you highlighted those four lines in your book as maybe having particular meaning to Johnny.
Yes, the song, and I adored Nine Inch Nails, a great band, great song. He wrote it as a song about heroin addiction. Johnny Cash, when Rick Rubin, his producer, first played it for Johnny, he couldn't identify with that song. He kept listening to it, and he changed some words and changed his interpretation to where it's about false values, how false values can lead you astray, and your empire of dirt. But that's so true, Veronica, that he was a broken man in 1970, 71, 72. His audience had found new heroes. His record company had dropped him. The quality of his music was not as good. He thought his record career was over. He thought he had lost his legacy. Rick Rubin, a hip-hop producer, goes to see him at a club in Los Angeles, says, I want to make records with you. He works with John to rebuild his confidence, and for 10 years, despite John's terrible physical state, you can hear his voice in that song. He's just barely able to sing that. And they made just astounding records, and they made a video of Hurt that was later voted the best music video ever made.
What do you think he did to get Johnny back on his feet? You talked about rebuilding his confidence. What did that take, and who was Johnny Cash at the end of his life?
Rick's idea was, I want to go back. I loved Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison. He was bold. He was edgy. He was independent. He was an individual. I want to take Johnny Cash at 62, despite the years of uneven recordings, the lack of confidence, I want to take him back to that and see if I can recapture that. And he did. Boy, it was one of the most amazing chapters in pop history, Veronica, the fact that he was able to rebuild Johnny Cash's character, and at 65, to make music that was every bit as good as the Folsom Prison.
Robert, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great, Rob. Thank you very much.
That was Robert Hillman. He's former music critic for the LA Times. He was there for 30 years. He's the author of the book Johnny Cash, The Life. And if you have a Johnny Cash memory, a favorite song to share, go to the Central Time Facebook page. I've already played mine, Hurt. That's just a powerful thing to listen to every time I hear it.
And this is one of my favorites right here. That low range of Johnny Cash. Love it. Well, coming up next is the news, and then we'll be back with a look at how states are responding to glitches in the healthcare exchange website. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Don't ever play with guns, but I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head.